I am Juanita Seacrest, and I am an alcoholic. I'd like to welcome everybody here. We're going to do this one a little different because this is our long-timers with a lot of sobriety. I'm going to have Ben start it off. I'm not going to get up and do this. I'm going to go through it one time, and then y'all will understand, okay? Ben is going to read how it works from the first edition. Now, that's a little different than what we read at our regular meetings. They cleaned it up a little. It's not as tough now as it was then. And Easy is going to start off telling us about the early days. Easy has 56 years of sobriety. Coco is going to follow him with 45 years of sobriety. Clancy is going to follow him with 40 years of sobriety. Then Peggy is going to follow with 34 years. And Dick is going to follow with 33 years. Folks, that's a mind-boggling amount of sobriety in my book. And if you would, let's open with a moment of silence followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And Ben, would you come up and read?
My name's Ben Humphrey. I'm a real alcoholic. And because I like Juanita so much, I'd like to make her a little bit nervous. But Juanita, July the 5th of 1977, I had a panic stage fright experience and lost my voice. And the person in charge had to do what I was supposed to do. So you just be ready for that. Really, that's a true story, by the way. I had one of those bad weekends, moved my girlfriend out of town. I had another knee examination, and I was late getting to there. And I was exhausted when I got to the Monday night meeting, and they asked me to read how it works. And I'd been told if I did what I was told to, that I'd be able to stay sober. So I got up there to do that, and I was so pooped I could barely stand up. And all of a sudden, some of the words disappeared in that direction, and some whizzed by my ears, and the rest of them ran over the side of the paper, and I was looking at a blank sheet of paper. If that happens today, Juanita will help me out. Chapter 5, How It Works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our directions. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a way of life which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to follow directions. At some of these, you may balk. You may think you can find an easier, softer way. We doubt if you can. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was kneeling to let go absolutely. Remember that you're dealing with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for you. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. You must find him now. Half measures will avail you nothing. You stand at the turning point. Throw yourself under his protection and care with complete abandon. Now we think you can take it. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as your program of recovery. 1, admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care and direction of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, we're entirely willing that God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly on our knees, ask him to remove our shortcomings, holding nothing back. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make complete amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our contact with God, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual experience as a result of this course of action, we tried to carry this message to others, especially alcoholics, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. You may exclaim, what an order. I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We're not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after have been designed to sell you three pertinent ideas. A, that you are alcoholic and cannot manage your own life. B, that probably no human power can relieve your alcoholism. C, that God can and will. If you're not convinced on these vital issues, you ought to reread the book to this point or else throw it away. If you are convinced, you are now at step three, which is that you make a decision to turn your will and your life over to God as you understand Him. Just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do?
You got anything else?
No.
Okay. I'm a speaker now. My name is Easy, and I'm an alcoholic. And my best definition of myself is an individual who had both feet firmly planted in midair. So I can identify with some of the talks that I've heard down here at this meeting. And this has been a great year for me. I have met more new faces. People have the same problem that I have and have recovered. And it's just a wonderful thing to go from place to place. And now that I'm up in my 80s, no holes are barred. I get hugged. I get kissed. I get my picture taken. You know, like some kind of celebrity. And I'm just a drunk. And I didn't do anything to deserve it, but things just get better and better. And my daily life is blessed. I wake up blessed. I go to bed blessed. And I have just good experiences happening all the time. All my family is well and happy, and none of them smoke, drink, carry matches, or use profanity. No dopers. But you see, they saw me grow up. And I tell you, this one little 5-year-old daughter, and her name was Peggy. And Peggy was with me the day the police pulled me over. In fact, my mother-in-law was in there, and my other two children, and my wife. And I was speeding. You know, I always used to drive too fast. You know, I had wrecked 14 cars, so I'm a good driver. And he pulled me over, and he talked. I had a new car, you know, trying to see if it would run good. Because I think I had 14 cars prior to getting into AA, and I never did pay for one. But I did wreck them. And the insurance was just out of the picture for me. There was no way for insurance. So anyway, Peggy, when the police officer pulled me over, got me the motorcycle and stopped me. And I rolled the window down. He wanted to see my driver's license. I gave it to him. And then he started in on me that I was in Florida and we don't let people drive like that coming down here. You know, I didn't back off a little bit. And he said, I could actually put you in jail. And, you know, my little 5-year-old daughter who grew up in AA, you know, she thought AA was better than the church. You know, she thought, well, boy, this, you know, they just had grandiose ideas about AA. She spoke up and said, you can't talk to my father like that. He's an alcoholic. But I didn't go to jail. But see, it's been like that all along. Wherever I am, whatever blessings are needed, they just come along. And all I did was join AA and live one day at a time. And these sponsors, oh my goodness. Nobody can drink that's got 7 sponsors. And I can give you their names and I know them. And they were right there all the time. I couldn't drink. I worked with them. They'd come to the house at 4:00 in the morning, want to know if the coffee's on. My wife said, what are these people? Don't they know a difference between night and day? And she said, but it's better now than it was before. So my need goes back to her calling the home office, central office. and tell them about me. Now, this is after I had a trial run of 18 months of sobriety after only having read the book. But I was in Florida at this time. I was in Jacksonville, Florida, and my wife had gone down there and taken all three children. And after I read the book, I called her up and told her how I felt about it. And she said, well, if that's the way you want to live, you can come on down. Well, I borrowed $6 for bus fare, and off I went. And I had a letter of recommendation that he'd be a good man if you can keep him sober. So I got off the bus. She met me. We had dinner there. The next day I went down to, see, I'd already drunk up one gas company. This was my second gas company. And they gave me a job. They gave me a job and didn't have a territory except for propane and butane. And then a week later, a territory opened up. So this was in 1940-41. And anything, that job just worked out beautifully for me. And everywhere I'd go, they'd tell them about my drinking and I don't drink anymore. I'd be bartender, I'd be all these things. They're just trying to show off, I reckon. And then when she called New York, I got drunk after 18 months of thinking that one beer would be okay since I had 18 months of sobriety, you know, and I got reason to tell you it's not okay. So off I went. I went 300 miles north. I always stayed in the car. I just really had so many wrecks. And I stayed drunk up there, and then I came back to Jacksonville, went to Miami. So I got there. It was about 30 days there, and I was at the end of the line. I got back. The house, everything was just completely gone. I mean, it was just gone. So that's when she called New York, and that same night, the secretary called me. And that morning, I had gone, man, he was going to let me cut his lawn so I wouldn't drink that day. So I went over to his house, and he was always nice to me. He's got had a lot of boats, you know, he loved boats. And we worked together as salesmen there, right, with the Jacksonville Gas Company. So he let me get out there, and then I called about the employment, and they said, come over to the employment office. And I went to the employment office, and I met the employment manager, and he gave me a job starting the next day. And I met him that night at the first AA meeting. He was at the AA meeting. He didn't know about me. So here I was, first AA meeting. And it really looked like more like an emergency place, you know, where they fix legs and bandage you and stuff like that. One of them had his arm in a band and a sling. Another was on crutches. And it wasn't too promising. There was 12 people there, you know, and I was looking around. I said, well, you know, I may not be this bad. Like the fellow that died, said, why didn't you get him there? He said, well, he wasn't that bad. And I was bad. Well, they started out on me. I didn't even have a car at this time. And they gave me a bunch of literature to read, you know. And we had meetings twice a week. And Jacksonville was a kind of a city where a lot of people just travel through there, you know, or going to Miami for the winter or whatever. And a lot of them would come by AA because money in those days wasn't too plentiful, you know, and picking up $2 or $3 was good for them, you know, to keep going. So I got a liberal education in working with alcoholics. And I would everywhere I'd go, I'd tell them I'm an alcoholic. If I went to the dentist, I'd say I'm an alcoholic. They don't give me anything. I'd tell my prescription doctor and everything. And he said, well, this guy says that alcohol is a disease, you know. Well, I hadn't thought of it as a disease. I knew it wasn't contagious. But anyhow, here I was in Jacksonville, and I called on this guy, and he was from Long Island. Dennis gave me his name, and I went and knocked on his door and told him I was an alcoholic. And his wife came to the door, told him I'm an alcoholic, and I understand your husband has a drinking problem. And if he can, I'd like to talk to him. She said, well, let me go back and see. So she went back to the bedroom, talked to him, came back about 5 minutes and said, he said, get all the information, and you let me know. Okay, he's the guy that took me sailing later on. He had a big sailboat. And we sailed the first time in our life we'd ever been in a sailboat, you know. And we'd get out there and race and all those sort of things. And just seemed like all these people I'd meet, you know, just. And I got one time I had an AA meeting and the Gideons came in and wanted to know if they could put their Bibles around. And I said, well, I don't see anything wrong with that. There's something wrong. I'll live through it. But he wanted us to get up and sing. You ever heard drunks sing? Sober drunks. Well, that was another experience. And these people would come in there wholesale, you know, from the shipyards of war, you know, World War II. The shipyards were loaded with people, you know, just down there from all parts of the country. And I worked for that's where I started off my career, in the shipyard, because prior to that, the gas company, the World War started, and wasn't nothing to sell, and by that time, I'd done started drinking again anyhow. So I was way in the shipyard, so started out 45 cents an hour, grinding the wine, the steel, the deck work, and all those tunnels and stuff in the ship. Had to grind the well off of, right on the river there. That wasn't too good a job. And then I was promoted to the warehouse. That wasn't much better, because that stuff coming in there was stuff I'd never seen before in my life, the receiving department, you know. And then they made an expediter out of me. And then they made I was controlling just more and more things. I get more and more responsibility. So this went on, and doing fine, you know, going to the old AA meeting. I couldn't miss AA meeting. They told me, don't you miss an AA meeting, and I didn't. And I might tell you, I had a little habit of playing pool, you know. I picked up down the road when I got to be an usher in the theater when I first graduated from high school, and I got pretty good at it. And I like to play pool, but I laid that stick down when the meeting started. They said, you lay it down. And I don't miss meetings like that. And the day, even to this day, the day I go to AA, I don't go to the pool room. And I've been, you know, I played some pretty good players, you know. I can't brag, you know, you can't brag in AA, but I played four of them, was in the Hall of Fame, and I beat one of them. So I had that ability to do something, and in a way, you know, it kept me out of other ways in this community because I would spend more hours there, more time in there. And I had a wife and three children, and my wife at this time, she had become vice president of the bank, and she was listed in Who's Who of American Women, and she was a personalities of the South, and she loved AA. And I had a guy who was bad to come in at times when Jackson went in, and she tried some cases. She got to be an attorney. And he would come in, I said, now don't let him in. And when I got home that night from the meeting, she had his feet, bathing his feet. And that's the way she was. She was a personnel director before that, and people get divorces and she'd get them back together. And some of them had twins after that. Well, in the meanwhile, I picked up a toy poodle in Columbus, Georgia, about 1 o'clock in the morning one day, and I took her over there. She wanted a toy poodle. Well, as a result of that, I had to cut the hair for 36 toy poodles over this time. And the whole idea was her to furnish these dogs to people, you know, that had bad luck and distress and things like that. And we would get letters from all over the country about the dog. They'd send us pictures. My wife had pictures that big of a dog. And I had a dog that would hold resentments. The only dog I ever had out of that 36 that hold, and he was the highest bred of them all. And he knew what I was going to do before I did. And he held the resentment to the point that if you ugly to him, he would wet your pillow, you know. I guess that was just his way of getting even. But I learned a lot from this dog. And that went on. So we had all these things. We had these three children, like they were 1, 2, 3, and then now they're 59, 60, and 61. And they're all contented, happy, and like I say, they're all doing well. And I get to visit. I can go to the seashore, I can go to the mountains, you know. Or I can just go anywhere. And my wife died 15 years ago, and she had she had some of her stomach removed, but she lived 10 years and was being able to be treated for those 10 years. And that was my time to make restitution to her, for all the times I had spent away, you know. So I felt a little bit forgiven, and it worked with the family. But see, what AA does, it makes these decisions for you. It provides something that's there, that's available. And it don't look possible. You know, it just don't look possible. And just like you've heard in these talks, these things, the things that are going on in people's minds, you know, that dream. Now, my biggest problem today is dreaming that I'm out of a job. Well, I don't dream I'm out of a job. I worry about my commissions for that month, and then I wake up and it takes me 5 minutes to find out I don't have a job. So I've been retired 20 years come this past month, because it's past November 15th. That was my retirement date. And I worked for a wonderful company. And they wouldn't take me on at first. They had three executives had to decide. Now, this is my third gas company, you know, and they couldn't decide. I guess I'm telling you what happened in the early days. That's what I'm supposed to be saying. But this happened. And this company had accepted me. Two of the men voted for me, and the other one didn't. And he had a drunk he'd worked with at his station, and that's the reason he didn't want me, you know. Well, I came in there, I got the job, they told me to report to Montgomery on November 10th, 1945. And I'd been there sober 3 years. And I came into the group up there and told them I'd been sober 3 years. Nobody believed it. Nobody. So as time went on, you know, they let me in. And the bad thing about it, we were meeting in the police department, you know, where they hand out fines. And I had spent so many days in that department waiting for that judge to decide what to say me to me. And he knew I had three small children, and he was rough on me. He talked real mean. I'm not sure I fully forgive him. But he helped. And then I went to Hillcrest, and they liked me out there, and they made an outpatient out of me. Hillcrest was a place where, you know, they could, I guess everybody knows about Hillcrest in Birmingham. But anyhow, I was an outpatient for 90 days, and it was the worst time I ever spent in my life. 90 days sober and wanting to drink every hour. And I finally, you know, you got to find an excuse before you drink, you know. You got to find an alibi. So I did. And that was the beginning of the ending, you might say, of my bad behavior drinking. So the thing that impressed me is when I met the people that I met in AA. Among them was Bill Wilson, who came to Jacksonville, Florida, at the Windsor Hotel. And we had dinner, and we had a meeting. And he couldn't go. We wouldn't let him go. We stayed there till wee hours of the night asking him questions, you know. And I asked him this question. I said, Bill, we got a club room down here, and a lot of transients come through here, get in here and sleep and get drunk and smoke and all that. What can you do about it? He said, well, the things in AA, he said, the good things will stick. He said, the bad things will eliminate themselves. Not true. But meeting a guy like that and all the other people that I met, and these seven sponsors, some of them were vice presidents, and everywhere I'd go, you know, I was welcome. And that wasn't the case. But early on, that wasn't the case. So when I was a serviceman, we couldn't sell stuff, so they made a serviceman out of us for half of the day. And by that time I was drinking some, and we'd go in a bar, and this guy and I, we drank there until we were broke, and I said, could we establish some credit? He said, we don't give credit. I said, well, either that or I'll get your gas cut off, which you prefer. And I could have turned it off. See, I had a ring. Well, I came back early the next morning to apologize. But that's how stupid and how crazy the things I did. And I would wreck cars. I'd get my head under the hood by the time the police were coming up, you know, and I'd stick my head under there. So he couldn't see me, you know. He said, well, you got to get this car off the road. I was up in some lady's front yard. I drove up the steps. And I got out of that. But a lot of them I didn't get out of because the car was just completely demolished. And it seems that I hit the things which caused me the most trouble, which brought me to AA that much early. I started off just hitting small cars, scraping fenders and things like that. The final car I hit was Highway Patrol. You think that ain't easy to get out of, you know. So the judge did give me 6 months. And that activated my mother to pick up the AA book. That activated me to go from Birmingham to Jacksonville. And that got me an AA. And AA just got better all the time. I could just stay here and tell you for hours how wonderful it was. We would take our wives down to the Mayfair Hotel for coffee after they meet. We'd let them have highballs and we'd drink coffee, see. And those waitresses was kind of looking at me. But those guys, there's one of them named Walter Thornton. And I met his son in Jacksonville. His son's been in AA for 22 years. And another guy I met, he was one of my sponsors. And a lady recognized his name down Sanford, Florida. I talked down there in Orlando, had a move a meeting over there. I had a big meeting there just not too long ago. And it just seemed like it's all the pictures come together and the things just get better and better and better. Now, I've had a few physical things, you know, but I had doctors, you know. I had doctors, and if a doctor gives me 90 days, I'm in good shape. If he gives me 30 days, I got to watch out, see. My doctor just retired. And here I am now without a doctor. And when you get 85, you outgrow a lot of people. But the way it all turns around, I had a tree fall on my house. Turned out to be a blessing. It cost $42,500. I wasn't under the tree. The tree hit the swimming pool and the deck, knocked the swimming pool, the greenhouse, and the deck down. I didn't need any of them, see, since my wife wasn't ready to work flowers anymore. So insurance paid for everything and gave me $25,000 to boot. Just because AA, see. The adjuster, my wife had taught him Spanish, see. He was one of our stooges. The man made the adjustments. And just all those little things just work. And what I don't deserve it. But I belong to the greatest group of people. And there's no more truth. There's just no more truth anywhere than there is right here in this program. And I've never, never, ever found it to fail. And with that, I'm going to get the next guy up here. But it's a privilege to be here.
This. Hi, everybody. My name's Eric Coco, and I'm an alcoholic. Like most people in AA, I come from a good Christian family and loving parents. But somehow, because World War II was along, and I'm not using that for an excuse, because my destiny to be a practicing alcoholic would have happened anyway. So I guess you could call me a product of World War II. Like I say, my destiny to become a practicing alcoholic would have happened at any time anyway, eventually. So, I finished school and the war was on. I'm a Canadian, started in 39. So the following year, I tried to join the Navy, and I stood up as tall as I could, and the big chief at the recruiting officer said, "Get the hell out of here, kid. Come back here when you're 17. So I even had a written permission from my mother, which she had to have in Canada. And so I convinced her then that I could go sailing as this, you know, on the Great Lakes. And she thought, well, that would be safe. It wouldn't be bad. What I didn't tell her is that company had ships that went down the canals and went out to sea. So that following winter, I went out to sea and I became a sailor. And I became a drunken sailor. And I became an alcoholic drunken sailor in short order. It just happens that way. And they followed the tradition of the sea. Very well. I did everything like sailors did. I spent part of my money on whiskey and rum and part of my money on wine and women, and the rest I spent foolishly on socks and underwear and cigarettes, razor blades. I started to shave by this time. I used to cut myself all the time. And so I went on my merry way, and I was at sea, and the ships were getting sunk, and some of them had friends of mine on it, and you know, losing our buddies is just like soldiers losing their comrades. So I was in Montreal, I was trying to get next to a very pretty little gal, and I had a sailor's woolen cap on and one of those pea jackets with the anchors or buttons with the big anchors on them, and she looked at me and she said, "Get the hell away from me, you draft dodger." Well, I was crushed, you know. And then I realized I'm about to turn 17, so I made a beeline to the recruiting office, and I'm in the Navy. I get the uniforms, no more problems with the ladies. Not those kind of problems. There's others developed later, but I went on my merry way, and I met the woman I wanted to spend the rest of my life with. After I had blown the mission, I'm not going to get into the drunkologue, but we blow the opportunities of a lifetime because of booze. I was selected as potential officer's material during training. I had joined as an able-bodied seaman, and that's if you guys in the service, it's like going into the Army as a first-class private. Man, you got privileges in boot camp, you know. I had seniority over my instructor. I was an able-bodied seaman because I was in the merchant service. So after I got out of the Navy, I was selected for that, but I went out and was late getting back, drinking. So my name was taken off the list. I said, "Well, who the hell wants to be an officer anyway? No one likes them." And, you know, being a kid, who cares? That doesn't matter to us. But later, after I got out of the service, I went back to the company I was with, went to sea, served my time, went to school, and I got a first officer's license. I was immediately installed as a third mate, a bosun's mate. I won the old rust buckets that they come back after the war that didn't get sunk. And I was a very good rigger, and that's why they sent me down. It wasn't long, 3 or 4 days, I had the rigging all done and everything. So, see, as alcoholics, we do really put out, and we're very good at what we do. And if we want to, we can do stuff in half the time. Because once we're done, we can go and party, see? So I went out and partied, and it was after the weekend. So I think it was Monday morning, I was on deck and talking to the boys, and one of the owners had come aboard. He went back to talk to the chief engineer, and he was coming up the deck to see the captain. He was on the other side, and he came on towards us. And one of the guys said, "Hey, that old man's coming our way." And I said, "Oh, boy, he must have heard over something I did last night." And there were times where my memory was a little vague. So he came over, and I turned around, and I said, "Good morning, Mr. McKellar." And he was the fatherly type of the company. The other guy was a captain, and he was a Captain Bly. Everybody hated him. But the old man, he come over, and he said, "I wanted to congratulate you for... I hadn't seen you since you come back after the war." He said, "You helped save the country and all this." And he was very serious about it. "I want to congratulate you." And he turned to walk away and he said, "Oh, and also because you got your license." And he said, "You know, young fellow, you have your license now. You know you stand to be the youngest master in the fleet. Now here's God telling you that you're on the first level on your way to heaven." Everybody, all the crew, this guy standing there, were all slack jobs, see, to hear this. Well, my head started to swell immediately, and I got my shore-going suit on, much nicer one than this one, and went ashore, and got drunk, and missed the ship, and got fired. If I think about that a little bit, there's a little pain starts in here, so I have to change the subject, you know. Golden opportunity. I wanted to be a sea captain. That's why I went to sea. But I did meet a young lady, and we got married. But... now, I behaved myself when I was around her, but her mother sensed it. Mothers are like that. Her husband died an alcoholic. And I was pretty good behavior, but she could tell. But anyway, we did get married. Well, you take a drunken alcoholic sailor ashore, he lasts about 2 years, and he goes down the dumper, and that's what happened to me. By this time, we had a child, and I was ushered into AA. Through the insistence on the minister that married us, my wife called up and wanted to find out what to do to get rid of me. And he had a brother that was in prison as a result of drinking. He had committed a robbery during a blackout. So he knew about AA, and he called this man and asked him if he would help me. The guy had owned an electrical contracting business, marine electrical business, and he had done work for the company that I was with. He also knew who I was and knew that I was... prime candidate for AA, except for one thing. He had a friend, his old buddy Frank, who was a World War I fighter pilot and a sergeant major in the Imperial Army, the British Army, had been an inspector in the Hong Kong Police Force. That's just like in the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. was drunk, fell flat in his face during dress inspection in front of the commanding officer. This was his third offense. They cashiered him. That means you rip all your buttons off and threw him in the coolie cells. And that was Frank, a tall, very impressive-looking Englishman. Well, when Kelly called him up and told him about me, and he said, "Well, he's too young, and you said he's got a watch and a car or a job." He said, "He's not ready yet." So when Kelly told him, "Well, wait a minute, Frank. This is a young," he knew what I was. He said, "He doesn't care about those things. There's lots of work around. He can ship out if he wants to, but one thing that's happened, his wife has left him. And I called her up, and she is not coming back." And she never did. She never did come back. So I had to learn it that way. So this man, he then took it on himself as a challenge, you see, because there wasn't any young people around to speak of. So he took me to my first meeting. I walked in there, and he said, "Now, just kind of hold on to yourself. These people, they don't think you belong here. You're too young." And I agreed. I looked around and I said to myself, "These people are all old. They're over 40. Some of them have got one foot in the grave and the others don't have any place to go." Kelly sensed that and said to me, "Look, go over and talk to that old boy over there. His name's Bill. He's a nice old guy." Bill had long white hair, thick glasses. He was all hunched over. He had a, looked like a cigarette package in his pocket, but it was a hearing aid with the batteries and wires all hanging out. So I went over and he turned it on. He said, "Hi, my name's Bill." I said, "Well, my name's Eric." He said, "Huh? What's that?" Turns, click, click, click. "Harry?" I said, "No, it's Eric." He said, "Larry?" I said, "No, damn it, it's Mary." So Kelly tapped me on the shoulder real hard. He said, "Don't talk to people like that." He said, "Bill's a nice old guy." And this is the part of my story that I tell why I go by my last name. He said, "Look, tell me your name is Coco. Just change the spelling a little bit. And then you can be anonymous for the rest of your worthless life." Now, we had a camaraderie because George had been a World War I merchantman. I was World War II. He's quite a bit older than I. But this is what I bring up when I talk about sponsorship. Find a camaraderie of some kind. If the person collects stamps or butterflies or whatever, try to find somebody who does that. Or fishes and whatnot. Doesn't matter. He said, there's all different kinds of meetings. This was right after Christmas and New Year's in 1952. We went to a meeting in Dunville. That's halfway between Buffalo and Hamilton, Ontario. We lived on the Canadian side of the border, the entrance of the Welland Canal. So we go to Dunville, Ontario. Now, here was a man, his name was Walt Mason, who had got sober about the same time that Bill did. Before, before AA started, Bill, he had the same sobriety, in other words. Like, Bill joined the Oxford Movement, and he was a year sober when he met Bill, Dr. Bob. Walt Mason somehow had gotten sober on his own. Maybe he got the Oxford Movement's steps or something. I never did find out. So we go there. He had been a minister, and he had been kicked out, defrocked, because he was drunk on his lawn one morning in front of his church. And one of the elders went by, so that's the end of the minister's job. But he got sober, and he got back in good graces. And there was a parish hall behind the church, and that's where they were holding their meetings. So we go in there, and the tables are in a kind of a semicircle. And Walt came out. He's a very tall, distinguished-looking guy. He also had long white hair. He had a thin, narrow face. And he looked and sounded like, you remember John Carradine in those horror movies with his deep voice? And I was feeling a little sparkly in the back of the neck when I still looked at him, you know. So this guy comes out of the side door, and he's carrying two candles about the size of stovepipes. And he set them on the table that was in front of these other tables and lit them both. So then Walt was over, and he sits down. And the lights go out. And yep, my hair started to go up the back of my head because it said, this is not right. Something's going to happen. And it did. He started preaching away to things out of the Bible and all that, the real loud voice. And then he talked about AA, and he talked about the 6 steps and the 12 steps, and most of it I can't remember. And then he asked us all to stand, and he prayed again, and he said, hold hands, and we held hands, and he shouted some words real loud, and then he said, do you feel it? And I thought I was electrocuted. And I said to Kelly, he said, that's okay. I just wanted you to see the different kinds of meetings. We won't have to come back here again. That's the first one. Then we went to another one. It was just a short-term one and nothing too exciting. The man that opened the meeting up said, my name is Frank. He had a nice suit on and he had a tie. And he said, my name is Frank. And he said, I don't know whether I'm an alcoholic or not, because I've never taken a drink in all my life. And here is the minister running the AA meeting. I said, Kelly? He said, yeah. He said, I just wanted to see what different kinds of meetings. So then, another time we go to Buffalo. Now, I didn't know where it was because I'd forgotten. The shock of it, I think, made me forget it. Until I went to the Archives Convention a month ago to Akron, and I met the archivist from Buffalo. And I said, hey, do you know about the thing about the funeral director? He said, yeah, Brady's funeral. He knew exactly what I was going to say. I said, oh, yeah? It was Brady's. Where was it? In Orchard Park? No, it was in North Tonawanda, out in the outskirts. I said, oh, okay. So we go to this meeting in Buffalo at a funeral home. And here is a guy who did not look anything like a funeral director. He was a big old guy. He had a ball on the top of his head, great big horn-rimmed glasses, puffing on a cigar, pacing back in front of the stage. And there's a curtain back here. And there was about 8 or 10 of us showed up. And that's usual meeting size in those days. And he was very irritated. And funeral directors are pretty cool cats, you know. Nothing too much disturbs them. After all, they have a job that makes them that be that way. So he started storming around up and down. He said, I'm sick and tired of having to go take you guys to the hospital, having to go and get you from the hospital, from the jails, and then you wind up here. And if you guys don't behave yourselves and get yourself straightened out on this program and stay sober, you're going to wind up like Patrick. And you jerk the curtain back, and there was Patrick sitting up in a coffin. I said, Kelly. He said, I didn't know he was going to do that. He lied. So that was my sponsor. And then the clincher was the following year, which was my first year of sobriety. He took me to Akron to meet his sponsor, who was Bill. It's one of Bill's salesmen. What we call the Latter-day salesman. He had read the Jack Alexander article, and he was losing his business, and he was cleaning up his desk, and he found an article in his desk, and he had stashed it in there in 1941 March when it came out. The following year, he read the thing and called New York, and he got a hold of Bill. Well, he became one of Bill's boys, he called them. My boy's on the road. Castelli got a job as a salesman working for the wholesalers that he used to buy some materials from. Now, as a fact we don't think about, Bill was a con artist, and he used every single possible way to carry this message or send the message around. A salesman, when he gets sober, his outfit will hire him back in a heartbeat. Because alcoholics, we're the best in our business of anything, whatever we do. We can outdo earth people in a heartbeat. So Bill would give these guys literature, like he did with Captain Jack on the Imperial Oil Tankers. Captain Jack takes these big books around the world. Salesman, literature. Irwin went down into Texas, great big guy, Elmer Gantry type, started meetings all over. And the guy came down into Florida here. And that's how it started. Now, he took me to Akron so I could meet Bill. Bill was a speaker at the King School Group. And he said a lot of things that were never written down. He said, after the meeting, we went to the Arid Club, which was still started at that time. And we went in there, and he said, look, sit down on this couch. Do you need to go to the bathroom? I said, no. I'll get you a cup of coffee. So he said, when Bill comes in, after he gets done greeting these people, they're all sitting there, all old people, some with wheelchairs, some with walkers and things. He said, I'll bring him over. You take the lamp off that table and give Bill your seat, and then you can sit beside him. Now, isn't that a wonderful thing that he did for me? And when Bill came in, after he got done greeting these people, it was very tearful, your reunion. All these old folks started crying. They hadn't seen him for a long time. And he thought and realized that this is going to be the last time that they're going to see Bill, I suppose. So he said something to Bill, and he looked my way. What he had told Bill was that I was a World War I veteran, two veteran, and Bill, of course, he was in World War I. Again, camaraderie. He came over and sat down, asked me where I'd served and everything, and then he told me the story about that's written and pass it on, about him almost getting himself blown up by his own gun during practice. And I knew that story before it was written. And now, Frank Mauser, when he was the archivist, he's retired now, he said, Coco, you're walking around with history and it belongs to us. Now start writing it down while your memory is still functional. So I'm doing that now, and I hope to get it written and send it to New York and see if they'll approve it. Now I have 45 years of sobriety, but that's another story. And another dime. Thank you.
Okay. And next we have Clancy coming up. if he's here. Is Clancy here? Yes, he's here. He was hid back there with all them women. He knows what he's doing.
My name is Clancy Imslin. I'm an alcoholic. The reason I'm sitting up there is because nobody told me I was participating. I guess this didn't come up in their deliberations. But I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad to have heard these old guys ahead of me. When I say old, I mean old in AA. Because I'm getting to a point, 40 years isn't a very terribly long time compared to these guys. But usually when I go to a conference, I'm usually the first or the oldest or the next to oldest. And most meetings I'm at the oldest, and I'm always glad to see someone ahead of me. I wish there were always someone going to be ahead of me in those rooms. I'd want to be the oldest. But I look back now, and tonight, of course, I'm going to lash you all into a state of apathy with my story. So I'm deciding what to talk about a little bit today. I know some of you have not been around AA a long time. I'll just talk to you a little bit. I went to my first AA meeting in the 1940s, like our previous speaker did. I also was a merchant seaman and also in the Navy later. And I went to AA, and I came to AA kind of directed there when I was about 22, which was not very young now in AA, but then it seemed very, very unusual. And I look back and I think, what was different about AA in those days? For example, in the 1940s. And they really, in a real sense, we are very fortunate today. AA is a much, much more programmed place, a structured place, we talked about, than it was then. It was very unstructured. People would get together and they'd talk about things. And if you happened to be in a town where there was an active guy or two who led it, it went well. But a lot of towns, they didn't have anything. They got together and talked. And I remember going to meetings in those days and sitting around. We just couldn't wait to get the meeting over to go play gin rummy and play cards. And I remember I first heard about AA when I got down the street upstairs. There was loud noises on Saturday night. They had a dance. And I said, those are the drunkards up there. And I stayed around AA a while, but I didn't. They all stopped drinking, but that's what, as far as I can tell, I never heard any talk about the steps. They're on the wall, just like a decoration, but nobody, you know, they're talking about it, but nobody ever. There's no such thing as you do these things, at least in that area. And I didn't stay sober a very long time, and I went to AA again later in another city, and I started going to AA off and on, then whenever the heat was on for the next few years. But it became quite clear to me that I was not. It was never directed to me that Alcoholics Anonymous had anything to do with me. Because these guys, as far as I could tell, were people whose problem was drinking. And like so many of the speakers we've heard so far, both speakers, I always felt my problem was more emotional, more unsettling. Now, I've only been talking 3 minutes and they're leaving on me. And then, in 1961... But I went to AA several cities. You know, you stop thinking about it. It's not surprising they weren't structured. There were no traditions. Traditions hadn't been accepted. They had the book. And it's hard for us to realize now that you read the first edition of the book, you think those are like the Christians in the catacombs in Rome, just great early people. And they were. But they didn't know much about sobriety. Most of the stories in the first edition of the book died drunk. Most of the stories in the second edition of the book died drunk. Most of the people in the third edition of the book died drunk because they all got sober. And then they sat around for a while, and that's all there was to it. And they had dedication for a while, but pretty soon just sitting around loses its magic. And you can talk for a while, but it starts to lose it. And I think the great problem in AA then, and it's somewhat now because we see it in each other, but we have a little more reminders now, is that I think that in those days, AA, alcoholism was still kind of thought of as an acute illness. You know, there are two different kinds of illnesses, acute and chronic. And an acute illness is something like pneumonia, where you very nearly die. And you're brought to the hospital, they drain your lungs and go to extraordinary ends, and they finally, you get better. And then you're all right. And then there's a chronic illness, which is more like it turns out later what we've had, where you have something like advanced diabetes, and you go to the hospital, you're almost dead, they go to extraordinary measures, and you get better again. And you're okay again, except in chronic illnesses, I must take ongoing steps to maintain the okay. And that goes against my mind, because my mind says, I'm okay now. We were talking about this earlier. A lot of people drift off after they've been sober a while in AA, and it's okay. And they stay okay. The analogy I always think about that in those old days, and since then, it's like a big ship in the Long Beach Harbor. They are kept by big mooring lines for which they pay the dock, say, $20 a day each, and they have five or six of them lined up on the big liner. And after all, why should I pay $20 a day? It's very calm here. You don't need those midship lines. Just keep the bow and the stern lines. And pretty soon, why am I paying that? Get rid of that stern line. Pretty soon, get rid of the bow line. And you're still fine. But one day a storm comes up, and you start to drift. Then it's too late. Another analogy I used to tell newcomers about is doing things. You don't need the things here until you need them. But it's like not having auto insurance. You don't need it till all of a sudden, as you're skidding through the intersection, you think, oh, Jesus, I want to get some auto insurance. And it's just and that's the way it is for us. But I went to AA off and on in different cities, and I don't know. I'm sure they had good AA, but my perception was such that it just turned me off. I'd go there and get sober and feel bad and leave. And I did that in a lot of cities. And I finally stayed sober. I think one thing about the old days that might be of somewhat interest. It's a small, little, tedious anecdote, but I don't want to take too long. But in 1960, I was finally sober. I'd been sober about a year and a year and a half, I guess. And they held the International Convention in Long Beach. And my sponsor said, I want you to go to the Long Beach Convention. And I didn't want to go, because I'd been somewhat successful. I'd alienated a lot of people, and tried to impress a lot of people by being a big shot, and I was no longer a big shot. I was broke, down and out, could not hold a job, no front teeth, had been kicked out, terrible clothes, just terrible. I'll go down there, and some of those people will see me and say, ah, you son of a bitch, you finally got what you got coming. I'd want to hear that. I said, I don't believe I want to go down there, Bob. He said, we don't care, just go down there. So I went down this convention in Long Beach, and they had a big opening meeting on Friday night, and in the Long Beach football stadium. Who ever thought of an AA meeting in a football stadium? First time ever held outdoor football stadium. And the largest group of sober alcoholics in the history of the world up to that time, about 10,000 people, I think, which is nothing now. But they had two entrances. One was over there and one was over here. All it seems to be the society people and decent people in their nice clothes stayed over there. And a few of us slippers and drones and whiners hung over here. The Quasimodo entrance. But they weren't very well organized. Then the guy came out and he said, "I'm looking for volunteers. We need some volunteers out at our entrance." He said, "We need some ushers. We have no ushers. We need some ushers. Anybody want to volunteer?" I said, "I didn't want to be an usher, but I wanted to get out of sight." So they gave us a blue armband that said "usher." They said, "Now try to find handicapped people or old people and help them to receive." And I stood by the door, and I snatched the first old lady off who came in, took her right down to the front row, put her in that seat, took off my badge, sat next to her. And I might have been crazy, but I never was stupid. And the stage was about up from this wall to that front row. And I barely filled in, and the meeting started. The chairman was Bill Wilson. And he got up and he introduced people. He introduced his wife. And he introduced Sister Ignatia. Then he had Ebby say a few words. My sponsor. The only time Ebby ever talked at the convention. And this went on and on. I said, it was like going to Gettysburg and suddenly the original cast is there battling the battle again. I just couldn't believe it. I'd been hearing about these people for years. I'd been in LA for a dozen years by that time. And here it was all taken. They're all talking about the living history. And I just sat there. I just couldn't believe it. I was so flabbergasted. And then finally, after all this went on, then Bill Wilson told his story. And he went on to some kind of a long talk. And it gets kind of cold in California tonight because it's basically a desert. And I noticed some of these fancy people around there, fancy ladies in their short sleeves, little dresses, were sneaking off. And I guess they'd heard him talk many times. I didn't know that. I just realized they were sneaking off, walking out like they walked out on Marsha this morning. Just could hardly hear the speaker over the footfalls of the people. But I know how offended I was, because all of a sudden I was enthralled, I wanted to shout, how dare you leave this meeting? You wouldn't even be alive if it weren't for that guy. Now you're a little cold, are you? You ought to be ashamed. By the way, what's her name, Wing? Nell Wing? She's got a book out, talks about that meeting. I forgot that little anecdote. I guess I got some newspapers since it got cold and shoved them under my coat to keep warm, but she noticed that. I didn't remember that. But they all left, and God, to get done with the story, I had tears in my eyes. My life was changed. And I became a new man for over 5-6 days. Just one. And I gradually went back to my same old. But I often, you know, and since after that, I had the opportunity when I was about 5 years old to be in New York and sit and talk to Bill Wilson for an hour, and I met him at various places and got to know some of these people. I didn't think much about it. But the funny thing is this. The one thing I want to say if you're new, you will hear old-timers again and again say, you should have been around here in the old days. We were sincere, goddammit. We wanted this program. We didn't bunch of dilettantes here sitting around with your finger in your ear here. I'll tell you what happens. AA does change, and I'll give you a perfect example of it. In 1965, I had now been sober a while. I was working in television in Hollywood. I'd become somewhat successful. My wife and children had returned to me. And I had, through a miracle of spirituality, grown new front teeth. We are like men who have lost their front teeth. Only spiritual ones grow them back. And they're going to have it in the big convention in Toronto. And I could go this time. And I took my wife and kids and dropped them off in Wisconsin to visit their loved ones. And I went on to Toronto and got there on Friday night. Went to the Toronto Maple Leaf Auditorium, big hockey rink. And Bill Wilson was the speaker that night. And there's some things going on. They did some other things, kind of boring little things, I guess. And then they had Bill Wilson talk. And he went on some length with his story. And I found myself thinking, Jesus, you know. I mean, I'd like to hear you, Bill, but I don't want to spend my entire weekend listening to this story. I've heard that already. I want to mix around and see some of my friends. Let's come over AA anyway. And I thought about that later. I thought, there is exactly the message of AA. Nothing changes really in AA, but my perceptions change. And when my stomach is full and I'm feeling good, I'm a little more. I don't need all this crap quite as badly as I did. And that's all served me in good stead, because I've always envied those. I used to envy people who could get away from AA and be all right, like those big liners, until I saw a few of them caught in a storm. But secondly, I've been very fortunate, because I get away from AA very long, a week or 2 weeks, and I can really see a significant difference. And it goes back to those things I learned in those days. Nothing has changed, but my perception has changed. And I still, after all these years, I'm sure I'm like these guys. I haven't heard anything new in an AA meeting in 30 years, any longer. But every time I go to a meeting, and it's a good meeting, I go home feeling as though I'd heard some new things, and I feel refreshed, because it's an emotional redirection of myself. The old days are great, but we can't, as we were saying at lunch today, or breakfast, or somewhere, sometimes we have a tendency to make a big kind of a mystic thing out of the early days. There's nothing mystic. There are a bunch of drunks, and most of them died drunk, and the ones that stayed on were fortunate people. And sometimes we can get around so much in the cult of the old days, we haven't got time to do what we're supposed to be doing now. I'm sorry, I'm talking about the archives. I can't take a newcomer to a meeting. And that's not the name of the game. This is a dynamic program of now. And to all intents and purposes, there wasn't any AA before last year, and there won't be any after next year. So we better take care of now. Thank you.
And we have Peggy M. up next with 34 years.
Wouldn't you just love to follow him? Peg Martin, alcoholic. And they're leaving in massive droves now, Clancy. They have heard what they need to hear. Let's go. Really, there isn't anything you can say after what Clancy just said. It is exactly... That is exactly the whole thing. And I said it last night, and I will say it again many, many times. The hard thing is not really getting to AA in the first place. The hard thing is staying in AA over the long haul. Because as an alcoholic, the thing I don't like to do is do things over the long haul. I want the glory and the excitement of, you know, what's going on right now, and I don't want to stay in over the long haul, which is why it is so important to stay in the now. You know, I don't want to be an old-timer. I don't want to be an old-timer. I want to come to Alcoholics Anonymous as though it was brand new to me every day. And some days it is, and some days it's not. Some days it is boring. It is glum. It is repetitive. It is, oh, that old SOB is going to say the same old thing all over again, just like he did last week. Why doesn't he shut up? Where's the respect for time? Blah, blah, blah. And some days the same guy can say something and it is like completely new and I have never heard him say it before and he's just the cutest little old thing. You know, and it really just depends on where I am in my spiritual program. Bottom line is, AA is way bigger than it was when I first got sober. When I first got sober in 1964, it was very small. And there was only really one other woman in the group that was sober longer than I was and she did not. I didn't go up and ask her to sponsor me. She came up and said, you look new, and I'm your sponsor. I didn't have an opportunity to choose who I wanted to sponsor me. People take me out to lunch now to interview me to see if I'm politically correct or something. I don't know. And we didn't have to worry about being politically correct then because everything was fair game. You know, I mean, newcomers especially. You know, you could tease them unmercifully and nobody cared. Now, you know, we don't want to hurt their itty-bitty feelings because they're so sensitive, you know. And I don't, you know, I was telling that at lunch, we were talking at the barbecue place down here, which is pretty good. We were talking about this group of people in Omaha who are of the sort of the new wave AA. I suppose, if there is such a thing. But they are the people who believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is for everyone. And everybody should be welcome. I mean, it's almost like we should have an AA meeting in that thing under the runway in O'Hare. You know, where those lights are going, you know. And they say that it's for everyone and that we must never hurt anyone's feelings and we must listen to... And they believe that our group of not the AAs are politically incorrect and insensitive. And I think they're crybabies. So, of course, there's something for everybody in AA, isn't there? But regardless of that, then it was little, and now it's much bigger, but the principle is the same. Then, in 1964, when I walked into that meeting at St. Albans Church, it was one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. It was somebody shaking my hand. It was somebody saying welcome. Now, where we have, you know, my home group of 450 or so people, when you walk in that meeting, somebody shakes your hand and somebody welcomes you to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's just the same. So in some ways it's very different, and personally I'm glad in a sense because the face of AA has changed. They're a lot better looking than they were when we got sober. They were, they were skaggy looking when, I mean, the women were like rode hard and put up wet. I mean, they were bad looking. And now today they come in and it looks almost like they hardly have a dent in their armor, you know. It's just, I don't like them that way anyway. I like them when they come in ugly. You know, ugly and maybe drooling a little bit or something. You know, I like them that way because there was a woman in our group not too long ago who was just drunk, you know. And you just don't see the real, you know, like really drunk people come in. And she was drunk and she thought everything was funny. And she thought the meeting was wonderful. You know, she was just laughing and stuff. And she was sitting right next to me. And I was like to snuggle up next to her because she just smelled great. You know, she was like having a synthetic slip or something, you know, with her breathing her fume. But in the long run, it's just the same. You know, it's one alcoholic passing along the message to another alcoholic. And it doesn't make any difference whether it's a little group or a big group or a huge small organization or a huge organization. As long as we maintain and retain that primary purpose, we'll be okay. Thank you.
That was wonderful. Okay, Dick, you want to follow that?
He's a baby. He's just got 33 years.
I never let him forget it.
My name is Dick Martin, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
everybody. By the grace of God and actions of AA and sponsorship, I've been sober since September the 15th, 1965, and I'm very grateful for that this afternoon. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, they were talking about the face of AA changing, and that's very true. There wasn't any such thing as a big book study when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. There wasn't any such thing. I didn't know of any men's stag meetings. I didn't know of any women's stag meetings. I'd never heard of someone that was going to spend the time to go through the steps over the weekend and have a step study. Certainly, no one would ever think of having a study of the traditions over the weekend. Far from that, traditions were for the people who are involved in the politics of AA, and service structure was much thought of as being some sort of a political entity. What was really thought of a lot was going on 12-step calls. What was really thought of a lot was reaching out to help somebody else. Not putting an extra buck in the pot, but really actually going out on a 12-step call, like getting a phone call and saying, from the central office and saying, we need someone to go out and talk to this person. And that doesn't happen anymore. Or it happens very little. The Alcoholics Anonymous, when I came in, they had de-emphasized the big book. There were a lot of people who thought that Bill Wilson was making an extraordinary amount of money off of the big book. That he was getting goofy anyway, and we're not sure when he turned goofy, and maybe he turned goofy when he was writing the big book. And the people in Texas and Oklahoma raised hell with AA World Services and suggested that they might stop de-emphasizing the sale of the big book or else they were going to stop contributing. And they were major contributors to AA World Services. And so the purse strings had something to do with controlling AA World Services, and they stopped doing that. And the big book still didn't go anywhere. The sales of the big book were relatively small, and certainly the others were. As it has been described by Clancy, the meetings were not, they were not generally oriented towards the steps. There were discussion meetings and there were speaker meetings, and most of the speaker meetings were involved with someone telling a drunkologue or going through some career definition or some career analogy or something to that effect. I was telling Clancy, I leaned over and I said, well, it all started for me at a little 5,000-watt radio station in Washington, Silver Spring, Maryland. A lot of it did. That was when my drinking was acceptable to everyone, including me. And it made me a lot more exciting person. I was associated with a lot of people in the show business era of those days, and in the late 50s and very early 60s. And it was a great time. I was a musical program director for a radio station, and I was telling Clancy, my sister sent me a magazine, talked about the first concert of the Beatles being in the United States. It was in Washington, D.C. in 1964. In 1963, I'd been in correspondence with a guy in London who was a disc jockey, and he had sent me a wax recording of the Beatles singing I Want to Hold Your Hand. I gave it to our afternoon disc jockey, and he was the first disc jockey to ever play a Beatles record in the United States. And so I, played a little role here and a little fun there and had some excitement in my life and did a lot of things. But by the time I came to AA, AA had been described to me as a place where there were people there who were willing to help people like me. And I didn't know what the hell was wrong with me. No one else seemed to know what was wrong with me. But I went and I began to take the actions of AA. And most of the actions of AA that I did didn't have to do with the steps. Most of them, or it didn't seem like they did. It seemed like what was happening is I was just going to a lot of meetings, and I was, I remember asking the fellow who 12-stepped me, I said, what's a sponsor? And he said, I'm a sponsor. He said, I'm your sponsor. So we didn't choose sponsors, as Peggy described. It wasn't so much of a choice of choosing sponsors in those days. Whoever 12-stepped you and helped you and took you to your first meeting was your sponsor. And that was just a natural course of events. there was not a lot of sponsorship changing. I mean, if somebody changed sponsors, everybody was abuzz about it. It was a terrible thing that was going on. Someone, he's changed sponsors. You know. Why did he do that? Well, we don't know. You know, and that was a, you know. But nowadays, they seem to change sponsors whether they need to or not. I'm sponsoring a guy for the second time, and he had two sponsors in between, and I told him this last time, I said, you know, if you want me to sponsor you, I'll be glad to sponsor you. I said, however, I'm going to be your sponsor until you're dead. He says, what do you mean until I'm dead? And I said, you're younger than I am, but I'm going to outlive you because I don't change around my attitudes like you do. But but there wasn't so much structure, and there wasn't the conferences like this. This is not a large conference, as you all know, but I've been to conferences all over the United States. Most of you, or many of you, have also. And there was a time when maybe there would be a third or a fourth the number of conferences list, maybe a three quarters of a page in the back of the grapevine. And now we all know that not all of the conferences are even mentioned in there. AA is now the largest user of hotel and motel space in the world. And we don't realize that because we're 400 or 500 people here, and we don't think about that. But there are dozens of these going on this weekend all over the country and all over the world. And it's a place where we gather to get a little bit of extra oomph in our life, as if maybe we turn on the afterburners and just get a little extra kick and be able to have a little extra energy and get away from the drab phone calls of those people we sponsor. I'll have to listen to their drivel for a few days. And then we're all ready to go back. And I'll go back Monday. I'll go back Sunday or other. And I look forward. I'll get two or three phone calls Sunday night. And undoubtedly, I'll get a dozen on Monday. And that's the way that is. And I'll be all ready for them then. But that's what this is all about, and that's why we do these things. We need to get together to reassure ourselves that we're in the right place and we're doing the right thing. And it's kind of funny, we stand up here and talk about going to meetings and the things we do and the attitudes that we take. And it's really talking to the choir, because the people who are already here, they already know that, or they wouldn't be here in the first place. This is where perhaps the real alcoholics are, that the Big Book describes. People who really need to take the steps and need to do the things that we do, or else we're not going to be able to make it. I'm glad to be here with my sponsor. I'm glad to be here with a couple of guys that I sponsor. And I'm glad to be here with my wife. She talked to her last night, and she was talking about wanting to grow old with me. She says, you know, I want to grow old with you. And I told her, she never finished that. But what I said was, honey, you already have.
Okay. Thank you very much, all of you, for sharing. I don't know about the rest of you, but I got an awful lot out of it. And, you know, the only way to become one of these long-timers, and I like to call them long-timers because they're here for the long haul, is to don't drink and don't die. And one day at a time. If you would, let's close this meeting with the Lord's Prayer. We hold our own line, okay. Our Father,
who art in heaven,
hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. And give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, power, and glory, forever and ever. Amen. He's coming back at work. Amen.